welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC. So a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It is a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Ramtin Mojtahedi, who is doing a PhD in computing under the supervision of Dr. Amber Simpson. Welcome to GradChat, Ramtin.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. And hello to our wonderful audience. And I'm so excited to be in this version of podcast and happy to discuss my research with you and all of our wonderful listeners.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate your time. And I'm excited to learn more about all of the interesting work that you're getting up to in computing. But first, before we dive right into your research, what attracted you to come to Queen's for your graduate studies in the first place?
Absolutely. And that's a great question. So I want to start with a little bit about my background. Mm-hmm. I did my undergrad and master's in electrical engineering, and I started my journey in hardware implementation, that is back to my undergrad thesis. And At that time, I learned a lot about how the electrical circuit actually works and got some ideas about, you know, how I could implement theoretical and algorithms into the hardware. And then moving forward, I found that the data analytics and signal analytics is a very amazing area that I could work on that for my, you know, for my continual to the graduate studies, particularly for my master thesis. So that during my master's, I focus on assessment of the brain signals. And I had the opportunity to work with both humans' brain signal and also the monkeys, rhesus monkeys. And I work on the collected and recorded signals for human and monkeys to find out some connectivity between brain signals, between different frequency bands, which was very interesting. At that time, there was an initial kind of phase and introduction to machine learning, and it wasn't very popular just nowadays, which we are in the AI realm and area. At that time, I actually work on my foundation and background for the machine learning and also the AI related stuff, so that I learned and got to introducing myself to those areas. I found that the mathematics behind AI is actually something fundamental for my future research. So I work on that during my master's and then found that, okay, how I could kind of make those theoretical mathematics behind the AI into something tangible that could be used in real world. So that back in the day, by using the engineering side that I got from my undergrad and also the machine learning and mathematics of the behind that, I decided to combine those two concepts and, you know, work on something tangible, which I found that it could be very usable into the healthcare, particularly in the medical imaging. And I found that at Queen's, there is a very popular and very advanced cancer center, Sinclair Cancer Center at Queen's, which I found it very, very, it provides me with the opportunity to work with the clinicians. And also there is a close connection with hospital research, which KGH, which is very close to that. And we kind of have a very deep connection between the cancer research center as well as the hospital. And I found my current supervisor and her lab, Simpson's lab, a very active lab in cancer research, and found that the lab has the privilege to access to the largest cancer data.
Wow.
Probably in the world, we have access to the largest data set for colorectal liver cancer metastasis, which is secondary liver cancer in the world. And this is a great opportunity for working in the realm of machine learning. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, I decided to do my PhD and graduate studies at Queen's. So that was the main and particular mm-hmm. reason that I chose Queen's for my PhD studies. But on the side, beside our lab, I found that Queen's was a very deliberate choice for me. And it's also a big name university. And I found that at Queen's and also Kingston, beside the hospitals, there are other faculties that are close to each other, which makes interdisciplinary collaboration much easier for me. Mm-hmm. And also I found that from just writing some coding in the School of Computing to discussing cases with clinicians at the hospital just the same day, you could do that just by going from the School of Computing to the hospital mm-hmm. and then discuss mm-hmm. whatever you found by using your code and your results and discuss it with clinicians. That is something that very rare opportunity for many PhD students. And also beside that, I found that Kingston is a very livable city. And also the scale of the city is actually very kind of... It is very convenient because mm-hmm. you can walk or bike almost everywhere. And also, I found that there is a very strong sense of community, mm-hmm. both on campus and off campus. So collectively, all of these together helped me to this great decision that I'm very proud of today, which is kind of end of my PhD, to came to Queen's and also Kingston. And I found it a great opportunity for me to make connection mm-hmm. with both clinicians, with different faculties, and for my interdisciplinary research and also find friends.
It sounds like it really came together well, right? You combined your undergraduate learning and your master's learning and were able to apply it to a new problem in a new area of healthcare research. And then, of course, like you mentioned, there's a great collaborations happening across the university and with local clinicians. And then it's also a great place to live. So I'm really glad that you were able to come to Queen's and that it sounds like you've enjoyed your time so far. So I'm glad that you're able today to come and share a little bit more about all that great work that you're doing. So you started to touch on your research a little bit, mentioning, you know, the great data sets that the Simpson Lab has access to in relation to cancer care. So can you tell us more specifically about what your research topic is or what the focus of your PhD is?
Absolutely. At a higher level, my PhD thesis contributes to how to do an effective liver cancer management. Mm. And in this field of research, there are three main pillars, which as an engineer and also with the background of AI, someone with my background could contribute to the field, besides some of those clinical aspects that are already being done on the other faculties. Mm-hmm. And I would categorize those three main contributions in the field, in the pillars of, you know, finding and detecting cancer tumors, which means that reliably you find and outline the boundaries of a cancer tumor inside the imaging data that you are working with. In this case, the most widespread and most common one are CT images and CT scans. Mm-hmm. And this field is known as segmentation and segmenting cancer tumor, because this is the first part of the any sort of therapies or treatment plan, is to understand and detect the cancer tumor, understand that where are the tumor are located.
That makes sense, right? You can't treat it if you don't know where it is, or that
absolutely
makes sense.
Yeah. And then the next step is to understand what are the different types of the tumor. Mm. Because liver cancer primarily consists of the primary cancer tumors and the secondary cancer tumors. Mm. Primary ones are such as hepatocellular carcinoma or HCC. And the secondary ones are those cancer tumors that are initially being originated and generated and produced in other organs rather than just liver itself, such as colon or kidney or whatever. And then cancer tumors are kind of transferred from those organs and then back to the liver. So they are actually being spread by the other to the other organs into the liver and or metastasize inside the liver. So it's very important to kind of classify and categorize those type of tumor, because when a clinician, when a doctor actually being assessed the cancer stage and wanted to decide how the treatment plan could be, they need that type of information to understand that where actually cancer is originated. If it is primary, then focus on the liver itself. If it's secondary, then focus on the organ that actually generates the cancer tumors at the initial stage. So the treatment plan is quite different. Mm-hmm. So my that is actually the main part of my second contribution, which was the focusing on classifying cancer tumor into the primary and secondary. And the third phase is how you could use those extracted and detected cancer tumors into something that predict the outcome of the patient, which means that doing the survival prediction by assigning risk scores of the event. The event could be death or, you know, just being fully treated, so that by assigning those risk scores to each specific patient, you could have a better understanding of the outcome of the of the patient. So my research has been focused on these three pillars. By focusing on the deep learning based approaches, how develop those deep learning based approaches to kind of contribute in any of these areas. So that was a high level of how I my thesis actually contributed to the field.
That makes sense though, right? Like a, like you said, again, I think it's really combining all of the different areas and knowledge backgrounds that you're bringing to these to help clinicians better assess, categorize, and predict outcomes for patients, which ultimately leads to better patient care. That's in my opinion, right? That's the, that's what it sounds like. Yeah. So as that was high level, like you said, if you were going to explain your PhD to a friend or a family member, how would you describe the problem you're trying to solve in liver cancer care and what your computer program actually does with a CT scan to help doctors? Because you, you mentioned, yeah, the big picture and like those large goals. But for someone who's maybe less familiar with deep learning and machine learning and cancer care in general, what would you tell them?
Absolutely. So usually when I explain my PhD to a friend or family, I usually start with the problem rather than the algorithms or details behind that to be understandable by someone who is not expert in the field. So because liver cancer is a serious disease and one of the main tools that clinicians and doctors use to manage it are the imaging, particularly in our case, are CT scan images. A CT scan is like a 3D x-ray of your abdomen.
Okay.
And a radiologist usually need to scroll through hundreds of slices looking for tumors and then measure them and then tracks how they actually been changed over time. So right now, and back to the traditional methods and analysis actually have been used for a long time. The process is mostly depends on the manual labeling and imaging, manual labeling of the images.
So someone going through and marking things and looking with just their eye, the naked human eye, right?
Exactly. Okay, they needed the human eye. And it actually, the process is very time consuming and cost effective. And it's not consistent because it's very heavily, it's heavily depends on the radiologists and who assess the images. And also even in some cases, very skilled doctors, they might disagree with each other on the exact boundaries. So I would say the algorithms and the approaches, particularly in my case, deep learning based approaches that I have developed, are basically trying to act as a very fast and very consistent helper beside to the clinicians. And then when you fit a CT scan into the algorithm that I have developed, the first thing it does, it actually finds the liver and then highlight it. And then within that liver organ, it actually detects the tumors inside the liver and then outline them either in 3D or 2D. And it turns that CT scan into the clear map so that it roughly says how big those tumors are and it helps them to be and how they are actually distributed, and it helps them to get a better understanding to the clinicians at the very, you know, very first initial sites of this checking and assessing the CT scans. And then on top of that, also it helps to appearance of those tumors and give some suggestions what their type could be. And then, which I said that it could be related either they are primary or secondary type of the cancer tumors. And then in some cases, it helps from the past patients. It can estimate how risky are those tumors look like and how risky and how severe is the situation, and gives a clinician at the very site, very phase of the insights to understand that how severe is the disease. So that these are the broad overview and perspective of how my research actually being contributed, so that the non-experts, for those non-experts, it's not for replacing doctors, but also in my case is to being like an assistant that can do repetitive measurements and outlining, and also providing clinicians with some quantitative numbers and leave the final interpretation and decision making to the clinician team to make those type of the decisions to be much more effective, much more optimized, and much more informed decisions.
No, that sounds great. And I think that's something that's helpful to note, because I think some people might be afraid of the idea of maybe machine learning or an AI tool making decisions, but of course not. It's in the hand. It's a tool within the hands of a very well-trained clinician or an attending physician who's going to make the ultimate decision. But your tool is helping them make that faster and giving them more evidence on which to base their decisions. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, that's totally right.
So yes, it makes sense.
Yeah.
So me as someone who is definitely a non-expert, thank you for sharing the more non-expert definition of your work. So it sounds like your program has to do a lot of work in labeling, categorizing this wealth of images from CT scans that you're getting. How does your research help AI learn about liver tumors and CT scans, and how does it become more efficient at learning what it's seeing?
Absolutely, yeah. One of the biggest bottlenecks in medical AI is having access to labeled data or annotated data, because when we train and develop an AI-based model, either it's in the class machine learning, traditional machine learning-based models or the deep learning-based models, is that the model needs to be trained by using the annotated data, which the technical term is supervised learning. It's called supervised learning. And to train a traditional segmentation model, you need experts to carefully draw the liver and every tumor on each slice of hundreds of thousands of CT scans. And that can take an hour, even more, per even one case.
Wow.
And even if there is some, and as I said, even a very kind of skilled clinicians and radiologists can, in some cases, there could be some disagreement between those experts. And it is actually simply not realistic to label everything at that level of the details. And it's not possible based on the expenses and the time burden of the process. So my research tries to make a better use of those data. We already have by reducing the dependence on the dense of the labels and by using computationally efficient training strategies. One part of this is called in machine learning realm, it's called the self-supervised learning, which means that instead of asking the network to immediately learn exact tumor boundaries, I first ask it to solve simpler tasks on large collections of unlabeled scans and using some of the methodologies such as reconstructing mask out regions or recognizing when there are two different views or aspects of the views of the same CT scan, so that and then train the model on based on those unlabeled data. And this process helps the model learn the basic structures of abdominal CT images without having access to labels at all. And it learns the the edges of the tumors, some of the shape related information of the tumors, the context of the tumor, the location and spatial information of the tumor. So it learns those type of information or those type of initial information just by using the unlabeled data. And so that because the model have that initial understanding of those tumor, now the model doesn't need that large of annotated data to be trained on. And then it could kind of, because it has those general features and general understanding of the feature, then I only need a smaller label data set to fine tune the model to do the precise segmentation and do the segmentation to find the boundaries of the tumors, which is in the case that just training the model from scratch, I need a much more, 10 times, 100 times more data to kind of train that specific model to do the same work and give us the same output. So that this is a part of the efficiency and also things that I have been working on that. And also another thing is that I would like to highlight here is having access to the large language models. So just to non-expert audience, LLMs or large language models is the field of the AI, which focuses on training some AI models on millions of the data. And they have pretrained of the very large billions of data in the past, including natural or medical images or whatever. So the model have that initial understanding. And what we are asking is how we could customize and adapt those large language models to be specifically fine-tuned and specifically work towards our specific task, working on the CT images that we have, which is abdominal raw CT images. And then I have been working on optimizing those models by just integrating some specific small modules inside those models and then train them, instead of training the full model, all parameters and all parts of those models, just training some small parts of those models and then adapt them towards our specific task, which in this field, in a technical term, is called the parameter efficient fine-tuning or PFD of those LLMs. And then I fine-tune them towards our liver tumor task, which means that, for example, for large language models, you don't need to large data to be trained, because you can use those large language models which have been trained on billions of data and then just fine-tune it towards our specific task, which makes the process much more efficient and much less needed to annotate the data in the process.
So it sounds like you have been very strategic in how you have developed the models to be, you've both been trying to make the models efficient, but you've been efficient in how you have trained the models to become optimized by thinking about the best ways to use the data available and the fastest ways to get the most accurate results in training your model. Is that fair to say?
Yes. That's totally right.
Yeah, that's what it sounds. You've had to be very cognizant of how you can train a model to do exactly what you need it to, because of course there's only so much time and there's only so many resources. So the more strategic you are in training your model within the confines of a PhD degree or timeline, right, you're able to create excellent results without having to, as you said, find every annotated CT scan or get clinicians to annotate even more CT scans than they actually need to be able to create a really effective tool. And I have a question, because I know CT scans come from different hospitals, different regions, different settings. And of course, you know, some hospitals are much better resourced than others and maybe have cutting edge tools, and others are maybe working with a machine that they've had for decades that, you know, might be quite a bit older in the technology compared to some of the newer sites. So how does your research make sure that your AI tool works reliably across all of these different variations in CT scans and in data?
Absolutely, yeah. So in real life, the CT scans are not polished, are not neat. And there are lots of standardized methods that we are needed to pre-process those images. And as you mentioned, different hospitals, institutes, they use different scanners, models, and imaging protocols. And for example, just to give you an idea, some scans have thicker slices, some are noisier, and the contrast timing can vary between all those scanners. So if you train an AI model only on data from one place, it might perform very well on that specific those collected data, but fail quietly when you take it to the another hospital. Mm-hmm. So that's super important that the model be robust and generalized as much as possible. So a part of my research addresses this in a few ways. First, I work with multi-institutional data sets. Mm-hmm. For example, in my case, I collected data from, I have data from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, MSKCC, located in New York, which has largest cancer centers, data cancer institute in the world, and also other cancer centers in Europe. And then I have collected data from different cancer centers and different machines. And the model that I have been trained actually sees a range of the scanners and protocols during the training process. So these exposures help the model to learn features that are more about the underlying anatomy and disease than about a single scanner's quirks. And second is that I use pre-processing and data augmentation strategies to kind of normalize and diversify the training data. For example, we resample scans to a consistent resolution and apply intensity normalization schemes that reduce the impact of different scanners settings. So during the training process, I also apply random transformations, such as like changes in the contrast or slight spatial distortions to each of the input training images. So the model learns to be robust to those variations. And the third one, as I said, is self-supervised learning approaches, which also helps to build and train a generalized model. Because the model is trained to understand the broad structure of the CT images across many unlabeled scans, so it is less likely to latch on to narrow and site-specific artifacts. Instead, it learns general patterns that transfer better between the hospitals. So by placing a lot of emphasis on after training the model and validate the model on external validation, external data set, or in simpler words, on a data set that are actually unseen to the data I used during the training process, I could have a better understanding how the model could work in real world application, because I assess the model and evaluate the model on the unseen data, which gives me a much more closest to the real world accuracy and performance of the model.
So it makes, again, it makes a lot of sense, right? You are being strategic with how you train the model when you introduce it to different things and challenge it to make sure that it is being accurate across all these different variables. Like you said, I'm taking the noise out of the different data that you're working with. Yeah. So this sounds very promising, right? So it's very exciting to hear about this work. And you mentioned real world application, right? And this is very, very real world applicable. Yeah. So when you look to the future, how do you imagine your tool or tools like the ones that you're building being used in everyday hospitals or cancer clinics? And what difference do you hope they make for patient and care teams in the future?
So when I think about the future, at this time, I do not imagine a hospital where AI actually replaces clinicians. Instead, I imagine a hospital where AI is doing a lot of the background work, many of those repetitive works, so that the clinician can focus on the parts that truly require human judgment and communication. Mm-hmm. And it helps to optimize the process and less burden on the clinician, just do all of those background and pre-processing steps. For example, in a typical liver cancer clinic, radiologists might open a CT scan and find that the system has already segmented the liver and also outlined all the visible tumors and calculated basic statistics such as the total tumor volume and how that has changed since the last scan. This actually helps the radiologist to have a clear quantitative starting point. Which is not currently available to them, mm-hmm. so that they could quickly see whether the automated measurements match their own impression, and then spend time and energy on the nuanced interpretation and also designing the treatment plan for that specific patient, which is actually under the category of the personalized treatment plan. Mm-hmm. And also, on the other side, surgeons could also use these tools to visualize tumor burden in 3D and simulate different resection strategies, as well as oncologists could use the predicted and generated risk scores, as well as the tumor type classifications, as one part of their decision-making toolkit when choosing treatment or planning follow-up schedules. Mm-hmm. Also, as on the other cases, many specialists, they could discuss complex cases having consistent quantitative imaging data that helps them to make decisions or informed decision and focus on the evidence-based. And also, I wanted to highlight on a patient level that impact or in the future type of the technologies, they actually being helped them to ideally show up as a more timely and consistent care for the patients. Because if AI can help can catch subtle changes earlier or reduce the variation between readers, mm-hmm. then the patients are less likely to fall through the cracks because someone was overloaded or because two hospitals interpreted scans mm-hmm. differently. So it might also make clinical trials more efficient and fair, as well as by actually standardizing how tumors are being measured and also tracked. So these are some future beneficial benefits that could help both the clinicians and also the patients.
No, that sounds great. So it again, it's not taking away anything from the human approach of medicine. It's just offering tools to take away time that's spent on really repetitive tasks that take a lot of time. And in the healthcare setting, as we all know right now, no one has enough time for anything. So your tools can help assist doctors in spending the time with their patients and with that really personalized, individualized care that a specialist can provide, as well as, you know, making sure that, like you said, fairness for patients. You know, if one hospital has the newest, best equipment that gives the most accurate picture, a patient at a hospital with an older machine might still be able to get the same high quality care with your tool, even if the image itself to the human eye isn't as strong as that new technology at another hospital might be.
Yeah, that's exactly. Overall, you know, it helps to have a more consistent mm-hmm. and more reliable and also more efficient process for the patient, which can save lives. Mm-hmm. And this is very important. So that I think this technology could be deployable into the current clinical workflow. And I'm hoping this happens in a very soon years mm-hmm. to kind of being accessible to all patients that being used as an AI-based assistant to all clinicians and doctors.
No, that sounds really exciting. And I hope we see it transition as you finish up your PhD. Hopefully, we'll see your PhD work move into clinical settings very soon. And outside of the lab and research, I know you are quite busy with many other things. Can you tell us about some of the extracurriculars that you've been up to throughout your time at Queen's? I know you've got some mentorship activities and some other things that you've been doing. So can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, absolutely. So outside of research, I have been very involved in student leadership mm-hmm. and mental health initiatives at Queen's. I have had the privilege and being recognized with the Queen's some of the leadership and also academic based awards.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you so much. I have been awarded the Queen's Peer Leadership Award because of some of my engagement and also contributions to different voluntary based activities that I have been involved, such as with the food bank, with the with different on-campus and off-campus initiatives for charity-based things and also mentorship-based for the youth. I also being awarded for the SGPSA Award in Leadership, Innovation, and Community Engagement. Previously, before that, I was awarded for the SGPS International Student Leadership as well as the Academic Excellence Awards and also School of Computing's Ian MacLeod Award for my contribution on the intellectual and social life of our department, as well as some of the other mental health related awards, such as being recognized for the 2024 Champions for the Mental Health. So through my past engaged roles, I have been mainly focused on mentoring undergraduate as well as graduate students, which is also continuing even nowadays as a mentor to and have been involved in organizing the Graduate Computing Society, which is known as GCS Body Program, which is a program focusing on pairing seniors, graduate students with the other undergraduate students or even graduate students, and then pair them to get the being mentored by a senior graduate students at our department to help them manage their both academic and also the their life on the outside of the academic life, as well as also some of the other peer mentorship activities. Also, I have been involved in running some supportive stress management workshops, and also, as I said, working with the AMS Food Bank at Queens, and also help to promote the STEM and university pathways to local high school students. Beside all of these activities, I stayed active through some of the competitive swimmings and also working with my drones and playing music as a side type of the fun activities beside my
academic life. Sounds like you have a very full schedule. So I'm not sure where you fit in those extra things like swimming and going to the gym or playing with your drones and playing some music. So what type of swimming? Do you swim laps at the arc or yes?
Yeah, so beside the swimming, the competitive swimming, I won the bronze national youth medal, not in Canada, but before coming to Canada. I got that and I found that swimming is a way for me to kind of relax my brain and also just put all of those daily pressures beside when I just joined any pool, and then just focusing, improving my focus and mental health during swimming. That's why I really love swimming and found it a very effective exercise to kind of improve my mental health and also my physical kind of condition.
I agree completely. I also swim. So I know exactly what you mean, because when you get in the pool, you can't even have headphones, right? It's just you. You listen to the water as you're going back and forth in the pool and swimming laps. You use your whole body. But it's a really nice time. I know when I was doing my dissertation, sometimes hitting the pool to just take your mind off of things, but the swimming and being physical while you're not focused on anything in particular also helps work out some of those problems in your dissertation in the background. At least I found that. I don't know if you found that, but
yeah, exactly.
I found it a nice place to, it's quite meditative, right, to swim.
Exactly.
Well, Ramtin, thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been great chatting with you, and good luck with the rest of your research.
Thank you so much. I appreciate for the time and opportunity, and thanks for having me, and I'm happy to receive any feedback or questions. Listener audience can reach out to me, either email me or I don't know if that's a possibility to put my email there or whatever.
I'm sure we can put your email address, contact info
in
the show, so that people can reach out if they have any follow-up questions to learn more about what you've been up to.
Absolutely. I'm always happy to do that.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Grad Chat. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.